Okay, hi folks. Just to let you know, the people asked for a couple of the references, and those are posted in the hand resources or resource section, I think, or handouts. Don't look at them right now. I'm going to give a Dharma talk, but they're there, I think. Sorry, that was just the stress talking. Sorry. It's a line from the Big Lebowski. Okay. So we often get a kind of almost deified version of the Buddha. And I don't know, sanitized version, something, but struck by something as that Gil initially pointed out. Gil from the Atthakavagga, Book of Eight, was thought to be among the earliest Buddhist suttas, and Gil commented how touched he was by the kind of directness of the Buddha's emotional expression. So it's said that the Buddha said, fear is born from arming oneself. Just see how many people fight. I'll tell you about the dreadful fear that caused me to shake all over. Seeing creatures flopping around like fish in water too shallow, so hostile to one another. Seeing this, I became afraid. This world completely lacks an essence. It trembles in all directions. I longed to find myself a place unscathed, but I could not see it. Seeing people locked in conflict, I became completely distraught. But then I discerned here a thorn, hard to see, lodged deep in the heart. It's only when pierced by this thorn that one runs in all directions. So if the thorn's taken out, one does not run and settles down. So to consider the world the Buddha occupied, inhabited, the kind of amount of disease and violence and famine and infant mortality. If you made it to, I don't know, into one's 20s or something, you'd likely live quite a lot longer. But the life expectancy then, and for the next like 2,000 years, more than 2,000 years, was like 30, and there were very few tools to address that. The world ungovernable, longing for a place unscathed, but I could not see it. So then maybe the ungovernable quality is quite apparent. Now, in a way, samsara tempts us with fantasies of control. And the kind of, the poignancy, I'll tell you about the dreadful fear that caused me to shake all over. That was a moment of, I would say, incredible love and helplessness. And I don't know, but I think there's a sense like if he could have helped, he would have. If he could have helped that, the whole world, he would have. The ryokan famously. When I think about the sadness of the people of this world, their sadness becomes mine. Oh, that my priest's robe were wide enough to gather up all the suffering people in this floating world. What does helplessness do to our heart? You can feel the kind of, it can go different ways. And on my reading here, the sense of the vastness of suffering gave rise to a particular feeling in the Buddha, namely, Samvega, spiritual urgency, renunciation. This is Tanissaro Bhikkhu. Samvega was what the Buddha felt on his first exposure to aging, illness, and death. It's a hard word to translate because it covers such a complex range, at least three clusters of feelings at once. The oppressive sense of shock, dismay, and alienation that come with realizing the futility and meaninglessness of life as it's normally lived. A chastening sense of our own complacency and foolishness in having let ourselves live so unconsciously, and an anxious sense of urgency in trying to find a way out of the meaningless cycle. The Buddha sought to alleviate suffering in the way that he could, in the way that he could, which was essentially to it was not a public health campaign, right? It was an attempt to reduce the friction in his own nervous system. And even amidst all the brokenness, he demonstrated that it's possible to reduce the friction in one's own nervous system down to zero or something very close to it. And the Dharma, in a sense, is a catalog of the ways that friction is reduced. And that offering, that turning inwards, that movement of his own heart in the face of creatures flopping like fish in water too shallow, that the offering generated out of that, shook the world, continues to shake it. It's why we're here now doing our best to honor, sanctify the Dharma. And here we are, millennia later, and what is our relationship to love now? What does love entail now, given the kind of miraculous knowledge and power we have to reduce or generate suffering? How ought we live? How ought we live? Derek Parfit from On What Matters: if we are the only rational animals in the universe, it matters even more whether we shall have descendants during the billions of years in which life would be possible. Some of our descendants might live lives and create worlds that, though failing to justify past suffering, would give us all, including those who suffered, reasons to be glad that the universe exists. Reasons to be glad that the universe exists. Dharma, for sure, one of the reasons to be glad the universe exists. What Parfit is pointing to is a kind of the way that empathy widens across space and time, the circle of empathy widens to include more and more space, those around the globe, more and more time, those not yet born, born and to be born, as the metta chant goes. The philosopher Susan Langer described empathy as the involuntary breach of individual separateness. Very lovely phrase, the involuntary breach of individual separateness. And there is this breach of separateness. Where someone else's world becomes ours, becomes included in ours, where we become included in theirs. And maybe we say empathy as a kind of precursor to compassion. Compassion, the heart trembling with another. Compassion, and then its partner, equanimity. And without compassion, the path can almost feel like more greed, just more the acquisition of more happiness for me, right? And so, even our spiritual path can become another forum for self-absorption. And Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche famously said that we need to step out of the bureaucracy of ego, to step out of spiritual materialism. And part of how we do that is we dedicate ourselves to others. And so, compassion, a path without it is kind of cartoonish. And caring is costly. Caring is costly. That's the title of a research series of research studies last year. So the authors write, many suggest that empathy, which involves sharing in others' experiences, can be biased and exhausting, whereas warm, compassionate concern is more rewarding and sustainable. If compassion is indeed a warm and positive experience, then people should be motivated to seek it out when given the opportunity. Here, we ask whether people spontaneously chose to feel compassion and whether such choices are associated with perceiving compassion as cognitively costly. Across all studies, we found that people opted to avoid compassion when given the opportunity, reported compassion to be more cognitively taxing than empathy and detachment, and opted to feel compassion less to the degree they viewed compassion as costly. Now, that research was on, that was not on meditators, and I do believe we can get a lot better, that compassion can feel better, it can cost less. But I don't think it can cost zero, and that's okay. But it doesn't cost zero. There's so much to care about and so much to love, and it sometimes feels like our nervous system just was not designed to care all the time. And so How do we, is that even defensible for me to say something like that? How do we balance our love and our peace? How do we find our way amidst love and rest? Love and the alleviation of suffering, you know, we call it progress. This is so central to human aspiration. You know, it can feel like almost to stop making progress, to give up on progress, is almost like to acquiesce to death. Until I die, I will progress. I will progress. I will. And humans are indeed like often deeply lost without some notion of progress. And I'm not vilifying progress. I just want to investigate. We try to make progress in our lives, in our relationships, in our work. There's an aspiration, of course, for progress in organizations, societies, the world, of course, of course. And we see it just refracted through our own meditation practice. We sit down and moment to moment as we meditate, there's some sense of, yeah, how do we progress? How do we progress? It's like woven into our biology, progress. And yet to demand that things always get better for ourselves, for loved ones, that is fatiguing, and it can't go on forever. Progress can't go on forever. And part of, you know, how we actually make progress in our path is to give up on progress, strangely. And one of the hallmarks of spiritual maturity is where you're sort of like not preoccupied with getting somewhere or something. And so I'm pointing to the kind of equanimity side of this, the side of the heart resting. And equanimity, different ways of talking about it, but equanimity is about refining our relationship to helplessness. So we ask the question like, can we keep our heart open, relaxed at the end of our power? Is there a way for the heart to stay open on the other side of our power? And in teaching, you know, we emphasize equanimity so much because it always feels like there's some move to make, some dial to adjust, something that we can tinker with. And part of purifying our love is deeply understanding helplessness, which maybe is just a synonym for dukkha, helplessness. In the face of, you know, wanting to, that beautiful phrase, like gather up all the people of this floating world, you know, all the suffering of this floating world. And the robe, the priest's robe, is not wide enough. And so how do we relate to that moment? And to me, this is where, you know, kind of grief is just not a defilement, not an afflictive emotion, but a feature of a mature path, that our robe is not wide enough. And I think we learn to grieve in ways that are morally onward leading, that are not deeply taxing and jagged, that consolidates our love rather than erodes our faith, care. And part of our relationship, refining our relationship to helplessness, is learning how to grieve in some fluid way. So love and compassion and hope and equanimity, this is, we're in the realm of feeling. We're in the realm of feeling as we began the day. And what are feelings supposed to be for? Emotion, what is emotion supposed to be for? It's like, evolutionarily, it's a product of causes and conditions. It is shaped, right, by natural selection, that helps increase our capacity and tendency to respond adaptively to threat and opportunity. And but out of what cauldron have our emotional systems been designed? They were kind of designed, you know, across evolutionary time, but they were designed for a life that was much more local, and we're very global. And so in a way, there's a certain kind of like mismatch in our emotional repertoire, given our environment, right? So there's a kind of hypothesis of like evolutionary mismatch, where the evolutionary conditioning in earlier environments favored genetics that are now harmful in modernity, you know? And so like, we love calorie dense foods, right? But the widespread availability means that, you know, causes problems, right? To have, you know, what, at 40% obesity or something, right? It's like we are conditioned to love that food, right? And so there's a sense of like, oh yeah, evolutionary mismatch. And in our emotional system, like, I don't know, it just does not feel like it was designed for this world, for this information technology. It feels somehow like just mismatched for the moment somehow. And in the end, our emotions, they were really designed to help us cope with life, not prepare for death. And so becoming aware of our own mortality, that is huge. And beginning to awaken to like, we now as a species are so powerful and so potentially destructive, that we represent kind of existential threat to much of life. And how on earth do we open to that? How does the kind of emotional system that's been conditioned, you know, prehistoric times, how does that meet this moment? How well does the logic of emotions work in this context? How well did the levers of our love and fear work now? Martha Nussbaum said, emotions should be understood as geological upheavals of thought, as judgments in which people acknowledge the great importance for their own flourishing of things that they do not fully control, and acknowledge thereby their neediness before the world and its events. Geological upheavals of thought. So we must investigate, you know, we must do our best to be sober and thoughtful about this. How do our emotion, does their emotional system meet this moment? What ways can it be trusted, and what ways do we need to be suspicious? And there's a kind of fearless self-exploration, this very rigorous, you know, I associate Buddhism so closely with just like getting more and more honest about this moment, about the human condition, you know, just like a commit. We don't know what the truth is, capital T, but it's like a rigorous commitment to looking. And to stepping out of self-deception, as one teacher said. And much of what we call ethics, even love, is just a way to launder our defilements. We have to be careful. Right? It's very easy to call something justice when it's actually just laundering our vengefulness. Greed and envy might blossom and has and does into an entire philosophy, political and otherwise. But a kind of view infused with greed, hate, envy, whatever, creates the conditions for confrontation and pain. And so we have to watch for the ways that our ethical concerns serve as a channel into which our defilements flow. It's not to say we ought not care. Of course we care. But to investigate the ways that ethical concerns serve as a channel into which our defilements flow. And there are some kind of world events that serve as a perfect channel into which our greed, hate, and delusion flows. And it seems in war, in a lot of contexts, that we must have a side, must take a side, and of course there will always be policy decisions. There's geopolitics, But sometimes taking a side is really just a way of blunting the horror of it all. The kind of subtle consolation of view, the false consolation. And what is unbearable needs an object of hate, right? No. No, it does not. We don't have to take any side of anything. We certainly don't side with ourselves. Suffering with non-suffering. We have a finite amount of energy, a finite amount of love, and there is a cost to caring. And so we spend our love wisely. Spend our love wisely. What situations are tractable? Where can we make a difference? Where are people not looking? Where does my love feel like it's going in circles, not getting anywhere? Where is our suffering efficient? And I'm willing to suffer a lot, but I don't want to suffer for nothing. And so we find our position, you know. We find ways of spending our love, and that often starts very locally, right here in the pedestrian ways of one's life. Spend our love in part there. And our love is in fact, I believe, quite supported by our contact with finitude, you know, the kind of geological blink that is any life, the geological blink that is a generation or a century or a millennium. This is the end of his life, Philip Roth and the writer Nicole Krauss. Wrote History of Love and others. They were in dialogue, and she reported this, I think after he died, something that he wrote to her, two writers. "I'm struck," he writes, "by the fact that I'm still here. I become intensely aware of being aware of whatever I am reading, of whatever I am looking at, of whoever may be talking to me. It just seems to me extraordinary that I should be alive, still be alive, doing these things that I've been doing from as far back as I can remember. I am still here, still doing. Sometimes walking outside, I think that I have been walking under the same sky all my life. It's an odd and comforting feeling of posthumousness that all this is coming after my life, but is still my life. A posthumousness achieved without dying. Maybe I'm saying that there's a renewed freshness enveloping me that is unaccountable, an emphaticness now lent to time-worn things, a constantly recurring newness just on the brink of its all disappearing. Maybe all I'm saying is that I know myself to be living at the edge of life, so that, as a consequence, something previously concealed. No, this isn't it. Is it the fear filtering in as ecstasy, the thrill of still having what I am soon to lose? One is always intermittently stunned to be alive. Well, now it's not so intermittent. Years ago, I stumbled on a phrase I long ago forgot where, that captures in its grandness and its vagueness the situation in which I now found myself and for which I have had no preparation. Quote, a full human being strong in the magic. I'm speaking about a recurring sense of being strong in the magic at just the moment I am about to be stripped to the bone and far beyond the bone of all the fullness I have ever had as a human being who lives in time. I am to cease being in time and of time, which is the ultimate magic. My last moments in time, maybe that's the ecstasy now. So thank you. Offer this for your consideration, and we'll close here.